Hi, and welcome to the first of our audio lectures for English 95, and we're talking today about The Handmaid's Tale. And first off, sorry that it's taken so long to get any of this new content up. I want to explain to you a little bit why I thought audio lectures might be a great idea. One of the things that has prevented us from doing these kinds of things in the past is a question of technology. And one of the great things, obviously, about an online class is that we get to work at any time. I can be writing my content as I am right now here at 12:15 in the morning from my office in Old Mill. And you could be responding at 6 in the morning if you like. And that's great. And one of the things that we can do is do discussions and get all of you writing about the text. And I think that's really good. One of the things that we lose, of course, is the fluidity and the spontaneousness of a conversation. And this is one of the struggles I've been having, trying to take my notes from The Handmaid's Tale and turn it into a text for you guys to read online. Is this is a book that I've taught, oh, maybe half a dozen times over the last number of years, and in three different cities around the continent here. And one of the things I like about this book is just being able to go into the classroom and talk about it. And I've got, you know, voluminous notes here, but often the order in which we talk about things is completely decided by the students. And it's just me sort of leading the conversation as we go and bring things up. So turning things into a written text that's sort of set in stone was far more difficult than I thought it would be. So I'm going to try to do this audio lecture for a couple of the sections on The Handmaid's Tale, and we'll see how we go. We'll see how we do. I'm going to resist the obvious temptation of stopping and editing this recording and cutting out all the ums and uhs, which, as some of you will know who've had me before in the classroom, are many and happen all the time. But so settle in, grab your book, make sure you have it with you, and I want to work through this as I would a lecture. And I may have to imagine questions coming from you, but we'll have some more discussion on the discussion board about this. And as I said, circumstances have sort of conspired against me getting this done earlier, so it's 10-1. Imagine this here, it's 10-1. I'm in my office in Old Mill, looking out over the College Green. It's completely dark. I had to shut the window. It's like 90 degrees in here. I had to shut the window because there are a number of people, probably not students, I will say, running around in front of the building, screaming and making noise. And already security has come by twice to check out my office to make sure someone hasn't broken in, because they can see the lights from across campus, thinking perhaps someone has broken in to steal a copy of, oh, I don't know, let's see, the Penguin Guide to English Literature or something up on the shelves here. Clearly that's not the case. It's the crazy professor holed away in his office working. Anyway, so we talked in the last segment that I gave you online about language, and this is one of the things about this book that really fascinates me. And first off, we have the way in which Atwood uses language in such a great way to sort of give us clues as to what's going on. As I said in the first thing that I wrote for you about it, she drops us right in the middle of the action. We don't know exactly what's going on. We're still trying to figure things out. And language is one of the clues that we have, and the words that she uses and the way in which the narrator describes what's going on. Those are just some of the clues that we have to draw upon to figure out exactly what's going on. And of course, that's one of our imperatives as a reader. We're trying to figure out what's happening. And it's amazing, really, as I said, we spent a lot of time in that first chapter, how Atwood does this so subtly and resists the probably incredible desire to give us lots of exposition, explaining how this world came to be, who the characters are, those kinds of things. All that stuff is completely left out. We find out a little bit more about why that's the case and why the narrative is shaped the way it is at the end of the book in the historical notes section. We'll talk about that later. But I wanted to move on a little bit from the section we were looking at and focus on the next chapter that comes after that. And this begins section two, called Shopping. And what a sort of wonderful transition, but from this sort of very ominous way that the first chapter leaves off to you flip the page and suddenly it's shopping. Let's go shopping. And it again seems all of a sudden we're out of our element. We're suddenly in a different place. Obviously a little bit of a different time. It seems to be put together rather randomly. Again, the historical notes section, I think, explains why that is. But once again, we're trying to figure out what's happening. We have, in this case, more description from the narrator about the room that she finds herself in. And again, it begins very, quite unremarkably, a chair, a table, a lamp. This is on page 7. And by the way, there are two editions of this book, at least, that have different page numbers, so I'll try to refer to the chapters as well. I'm reading from the American edition, which is the one from Anchor Books that most of you probably have. A chair, a table, a lamp. Above, on the white ceiling, a relief ornament in the shape of a wreath. And in the center of it, a blank space, plastered over, like the place in a face where the eye has been taken out. There must have been a chandelier once. They've removed anything you could tie a rope to. So suddenly at the end of this paragraph here, right, you've got this sentence that sort of throws you for a loop. They've removed anything you could tie a rope to. Well, who's they? Right? Again, this is something that's not explained to us. So we have to wonder, okay, who are they? And why have they removed something you could tie a rope to? Well, the obvious implication is that whoever is in that room probably might try to attempt suicide, so he must prevent that. Then as we start to read on, again, it switches tone again. I can sit in the chair or on the window seat, hands folded, and watch this. She's talking about looking out the window, and how the window opens only partly, right? Only opens partly because otherwise you might jump out of the window. And she says, there's a rug on the floor, oval of braided rags. This is the kind of touch they like. Folk art, archaic, made by women in their spare time, from things that have no further use. A return to traditional values. Waste not, want not. I am not being wasted. Why do I want? On the wall above the chair, a picture, framed but with no glass. A print of flowers, blue irises, watercolor. Flowers are still allowed. Does each of us have the same print, the same chair, the same white curtains? I wonder. Government issue? Think of it as being in the army, said Aunt Lydia. Again, Aunt Lydia comes up again, the first thing that ties us to that first chapter we've read. And this question of what's allowed and what's not, and who they are, again, this is the kind of touch they like. Folk art, things made by women. A return to traditional values. And what traditional values those are remains to be seen. And of course, this is always, again, we have that question of naming. Something becomes, as soon as you call something traditional values, well, who can argue with that, right? What's the matter with tradition and values? But as we can see, traditional values here is again kind of a warped perspective of what that is. So this is really quite important. She's using their language, right? A return to traditional values, not probably hers. Now, language is, of course, here a means of controlling the people in the story, right? A way of controlling society. You name someone or declare someone to be a handmaid. You rename places and things. You construct vocabulary to describe certain practices, right? The salvaging, for example, those types of things. Language is also, as you know from looking at Ufford's narrative, a way for her to keep control over her situation and to try to, if not on the surface, on the interior, to remain true to herself. Now, we see this a little bit on page 8, we learn about her survival strategy, right? She says, I try not to think too much. Like other things now, thought must be rationed. There's a lot that doesn't bear thinking about. Thinking can hurt your chances, and I intend to last. I know why there is no glass in front of the watercolor picture of blue irises, why the window opens only partly, and why the glass in it is shatterproof. It isn't running away they're afraid of. We wouldn't get far. It's those other escapes, the ones you can open in yourself, given a cutting edge. Again, that idea of escape, right? Something very different, thinking of suicide here as an escape. She says, 3 paragraphs into that page 8, where I am is not a prison, but a privilege, as Aunt Lydia said, who is in love with either or. And we learn a little bit more about Aunt Lydia in a minute, but one of the important things on page 8 here is, as we get to the bottom of the page, she talks about all the things that define her, right? Everything except the wings around my face is red. We get a description of the costume or the uniform she's wearing. And then as we get to the bottom, she says, the door of the room, not my room, I refuse to say my, is not locked. Well, why do you think she refuses to say my? This, of course, would be the moment where someone would put up their hand and answer that question. But it's important because she's not allowing herself to sort of fall into the way people want her to think, right? So if she can control the way she thinks about this place, it's not her room. She's not taking ownership of the situation, right? So language is one of the only things that she can control, especially her internal language. And, of course, it's one of the levels on which the Gilead regime tries to exert its influence all the time. Pages later, one of the things that Upford does to try to control her situation and to try to learn more, one of her acts of resistance is by listening to what other people say. And you remember her listening outside the door to Rita and Cora, the two Marthas of the house, talking in the kitchen. And she learns various things from them. And on page 11, we start to hear things from their conversation that, again, aren't explained to us, aren't elaborated upon, but give us some idea of some of the things that have happened, right? You find out some of the things that have happened to, or that the other handmaids have done, things that have happened to the babies. Stillborn it was, or stabbed her with a knitting needle right in the belly. Jealousy it must have been, eating her up, or tantalizingly, it was the toilet cleaner she used, worked like a charm, though you'd think he'd have tasted it, must have been that drunk, but they found her out all right. So here we hear about some handmaids clearly fighting each other, babies that are born stillborn, this jealousy between handmaids, and also handmaids who've clearly rebelled and tried to, or successfully killed the commanders who they're with, who they've been assigned to. Later on down this page, we see this phrase she uses, that Marthas are not supposed to fraternize with us. Fraternize means to behave like a brother. Luke told me that. He said that there was no corresponding word that meant to behave like a sister. Sororize would have to be, he said. From the Latin, he liked knowing about such details. The derivations of words, curious usages. I used to tease him about being pedantic. So she teased him before, but obviously, as we see in the society here, the meanings of words, the origins of words, become very, very important, and words become important to Upford in ways that she probably never would have imagined they would have before. Now, as we get into chapter 3, we again start to see one of the ways in which language is used to control people. In any sort of totalitarian society or society where there's something at stake in oppressing a certain portion of society, language, words, speech, writing, all those things come into play and are important tools in and tools of control. So one of the things you do is, of course, you limit people's ability to speak. You don't let them speak freely. You don't have freedom of the press. You don't have give people access to technology that will allow them to communicate. Think about the ways in which the internet has been sort of policed in China, for example. We see this again in the character of Ufford. You remember that one of the things that happens to her is that as they're there in the sort of training camp, almost at the very beginning, is the handmaids are not allowed to speak to one another even, and only to speak to the aunts or aunts, as you might say, when they're spoken to. This comes up on page 14, I think it is, where we, page 13. So we get this introduction to the commander's wife here and her arriving at the home, and 5 weeks previous to this chapter. And she asks, what does she envy me? She doesn't speak to me unless she can avoid it, unless she can't avoid it. I am a reproach to her, a necessity. Right? This is, of course, the commander's wife, Serena Joy. Now, a little bit later on page 15, she says, I want to see of you as little as possible. I expect you to feel the same way about me. And I didn't answer it. Yes would have been insulting and no contradictory. And she says, yes, ma'am. Don't call me ma'am, she said irritably. You're not a Martha. So certain people are allowed to say certain things and others are not. And we see on page 14 that Aunt Lydia has, I'm just trying to find that reference, but Aunt Lydia has told her not to speak unless spoken to. So again, taking the submissive position, the subservient position, by not saying anything, not being able to have an opinion, only being able to respond to something else someone says. And of course, one of the other ways that we control people, control places, control things, and we see this happening throughout the book, is through the naming. And here we have, of course, all of the handmaids renamed. And how is it that they're renamed? What do their names represent? Well, you're probably, hopefully, thinking about how Ufford is short for of Fred, right? She's the handmaid of Fred. Of Glenn is probably, again, the commander who she is assigned to is probably named Glenn. That name, again, first of all, renaming something, someone else, gives you some sort of control over it. And, of course, the names themselves indicate one's position in relation to the person who is controlling you, right, the commander. So this is really, again, crucial and something that is always used to control people. One of the classes I teach fairly often is a class on native literature from Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And if you think back about the history of the residential schools that were used to educate Native American or Aboriginal children in Australia, one of the first things that would happen in as students arrived in these schools, again, against their will, often taken forcibly from the parents, removed from their families and put in these schools to quote-unquote civilize them, one of the first things that happened is, of course, those children were not allowed by the people who ran these schools, which were run almost universally by churches or governments. One of the first things that was first rules was that these children were not allowed to speak their native languages, this idea of assimilation. We would assimilate them by not allowing them to speak the languages. This is one of the ways that many languages have disappeared, to the point where they're barely used anymore, and there's only a few native speakers living today. And the second thing that would happen, excuse me, is that the children would be renamed. Their names would be taken away from them, and they'd be given Christian names, right, quote unquote. And this was, again, a means of controlling that population. By renaming something gives you some sort of power over it. This is very important. And we've seen ways throughout this book, the way places are renamed or retooled to become something else, right? And that, again, that idea of the palimpsest of the past. We see these buildings or the square or these the room that Upford is staying in, even bearing traces of what used to be there, but having a new purpose, being written over by this new regime. We learn more, again, through language, through the choice of words, about what's going on page 18. We learn about Nick, and Upford says on the bottom of page 17, "I know this man's name, Nick," which is, again, something that's powerful for her. She's not allowed to know people's names, only by their functions. She's not allowed to talk to people. She doesn't find out Nick's name through any direct communication. She overhears the commander speaking to him. That's on the top of page 18. And she says, "He lives here in the household over the garage. Low status. He hasn't been issued a woman, not even one. He doesn't rate some defect, lack of connections." And this is interesting because here she's using the vocabulary of the regime and not even thinking twice about it. He hasn't been issued a woman, which tells us how women here are distributed as goods or rewards or something of the sort. Women do not have free choice here as to where they're going to be going, the handmaids particularly. And she wonders if he might be an eye, just because of the way he is looking at her and seeming friendly towards her. And of course, we don't have any explanation as to what that is, but you have to think that it's there's the implication that the eye is a spy, right? And of course, Atwood is having fun with the phrase "I spy" there. Then we see language being used in a very peculiar way, again, between the handmaids. And they're only allowed to communicate with this really sort of archaic discourse between the two of them that that is a question of what's accepted or what's mandated in terms of the communication between the two of them. So, as you see on page 19, "Blessed be the fruit," she says to me, "the accepted greeting among us. May the Lord open," I answer, "the accepted response." We turn and walk together past the large houses towards the central part of town. We aren't allowed to go there except in twos. This is supposed to be for our protection, though the notion is absurd. We are well protected already. The truth is that she is my spy, as I am hers. If either one of us slips through the net because of something that happens on one of our daily walks, the other will be accountable. So this is, of course, one of the ways in which any sort of oppressive regime controls the populace. And that's the threat of being turned in by someone else. So you have to watch what you say. You have to watch what the words that you use. You have to watch how you use language for fear of someone being the person who's going to turn you in, essentially, right? And so you remain in silence. You don't use language. You're very careful about what you're going to say, right? She says, as we get down later, "She may be a real believer, a handmaid in more than name. I can't take the risk. The war is going well, I hear," she says. "Praise be," I reply. "We've been sent good weather, which I receive with joy." And again, we glean a few things about the situation through the conversation between them. But again, the lack of ability to speak or the fear of speaking controls them. And of course, were they free to speak, were they free to communicate with one another, they might find, in fact, that they have something in common. As soon as language is allowed, communication is allowed, rebellion can occur, right? People can communicate, people can act against injustice. If you think you're the only one who is resisting or thinking about resisting, you're going to be much less likely to take action than you are if you realize you're one of many. And so this is one of the important things that's happening in the scene that we learn about right there. Now on page 21, we learn more again about the ways in which language has been changed, right? We have, and Atwood, of course, I have to point out too, Atwood is a very funny writer, and she's very witty and likes to play with language. So you can just imagine her having this smirk on her face as she's coming up with words like pravaganzas or the occasional birthmobile, which sounds sort of more like the Batmobile than a an ambulance or something like that. But the ways in which the society have changed the language, and of course salvaging is suggests something positive, right? You're saving something, you're taking care of a used or seemingly useless good, and you're reconstituting it, you're giving it a new use. Well, of course, the salvaging here is something that is there to wreak sort of violence and scare people into behaving and again, eliminating dissent. And so this is one of the crucial things that we find out in this chapter. We'll talk more a little bit about their relation with the Guardians and Ufford's feelings about that in a later lecture here. And one of the things that we see on page 23 and on page 5, again, we start to see how things have been sort of retooled. And this, we have a few hints early on in the book, and again some later confirmation in the historical notes section, but we see in the ways in which the city they've lived in has changed. And Gilead says, doctors lived here once, lawyers, university professors, there are no lawyers anymore, and the university is closed. Again, important, right? There's no lawyers to defend people, to look after the law. That is mandated by those in power. And also, the university is closed, right? So learning is, of course, a dangerous thing. We don't want people to have access to books and words and freedom of thought. So that's closed as well. And this is the passage here right before that that's really interesting. This is the heart of Gilead, where the war cannot intrude except on television. Where the edges are, we aren't sure. They vary according to the attacks and counterattacks. But this is the center, where nothing moves. The Republic of Gilead, said Aunt Lydia, knows no bounds. Gilead is within you. Well, Gilead is within them, also in terms of the things that control them, right? The idea of Gilead is something that the ants seem to have great faith in, and some of the people, although we don't know, because no one really feels free enough to communicate their true emotions about these things, their thoughts about the state of affairs. But Gilead is within you as also a means of controlling you. That fear of Gilead being there to catch you when you rebel, to salvage you if you act too far outside of the norm of what's expected, or if you try to rebel in any way. Now, on page 24, we learn more about the past and what it takes to be allotted a handmaid. And again, the ways in which language is changed here. notions of freedom, words that we think of as being the meaning of which should be self-evident and protection, right? And what the rules were before. This is, again, a really interesting chapter for giving us some of this background information. And as I said in the opening introductory lecture that I gave you online, it's important to think about how these are, the way in which the society functions here is sort of an extrapolation and sort of a perversion of the way things were in the 1980s, and again, of course, even today. In fact, there's many things that are a little bit closer today than they have been before. She says, she's talking about the way, she thinks back to her childhood, and she says, and this is really ironic, of course, right? Women were not protected then, right? And she says, because she never ran at night and in the daytime only beside well-frequented roads. Women were not protected then. I remember the rules that were never spelled out, but that every woman knew. Don't open your door to a stranger, even if he says he is the police. Make him slide his ID under the door. Don't stop on the road to help a motorist pretending to be in trouble. Keep the locks on and keep going. And now we walk along the same street in red pairs, and no man shouts obscenities at us, speaks to us, touches us. No one whistles. All the things that the feminist movement has expressed a desire to see end, and have talked about and have criticized, suddenly those things are gone. But of course, at what cost? There's more than one kind of freedom, said Aunt Lydia. Freedom to and freedom from. In the days of anarchy, it was freedom to. Now you're being given freedom from. Don't underrate it. Isn't that interesting, the way the freedom is used? And remember, Avrid mentions that Aunt Lydia always thinks in terms of either or. You're either going to be free to do whatever you want and have all the freedom to do things, to wear what you like, to act how you like, to marry who you want, all those things. Or you can be free from the threat of murder or the fear of being raped or something like that. And of course, here all we have in this society is some sort of institutionalization of some of those practices and the reconfiguration of them to make them seem acceptable. But this idea of being free to do anything comes up on the following page of when they're talking about the word undone. And again, her fascination with words leads her to think about women wearing blouses in a particular way. These women could be undone or not. They seem to be able to choose. We seem to be able to choose then. We were a society dying, said Aunt Lydia, of too much choice. And she says, I don't know when they stopped having the festival. I must have been grown up, so I didn't notice. And the way in which as grown-ups, we often don't notice things changing around us in a way that children do. And again, the ways in which often change, dramatic and devastating change can happen in society almost under our noses because we don't notice, we're not paying attention to the way things have changed, and suddenly we find ourselves with laws or new ways of doing things that are quite terrible, but that we never saw happen. Now, we learn things on page 26, for example. We learn that pregnant women wind up having to be guarded, handmaids who become pregnant. Now that she's the carrier of life, she is closer to death. She needs special security. Jealousy could get her. It's happened before. All children are wanted now, but not by everyone. And as it comes down to the end of this chapter, right, we see the Japanese tourists who are wearing sort of Western clothing, and they're there taking photographs of this sort of very seemingly bizarre society to them, and taking pictures of the handmaids in their uniforms. And she says, they seem undressed. It has taken so little time to change our minds about things like this. Then I think, I used to dress like that. That was freedom. Westernized, they used to call it. And again, this question of what freedom is and how quickly things that are completely abnormal to us can seem day to day. And this is, again, one of the things that Upfred is constantly battling with, that desire to rebel. And also, in fact, the comfort she winds up feeling in her particular situation. We'll talk more about her resistance in a little bit in a separate lecture. Now, they ask her this interesting question, right? They ask her, the two handmaids, they ask them if they're happy. Again, a word that almost has no meaning in this context anymore. And she says, she winds up answering, Yes, we are very happy, I murmur. I have to say something. What else can I say? And again, the way in which she has to use language to protect herself, to save herself, to state the official, the expected, the required, ultimately, but how that differs from what she's thinking internally. Chapter 6, and I'm not going to go through all the chapters one by one, but just to point out a few important things. We have the chapter where they walk past the buildings, again, things that used to have a particular meaning that have been reconfigured, renamed, repurposed, that's not even a word, and essentially, again, they're palimpsests. The people who have memory of what they used to be can see the traces of those sort of past identities. But again, it's easy to forget. And it's easy for things to become normalized, to become ordinary. Ordinary, said Aunt Lydia, it's the bottom of page 33, is what you're used to. This may not seem ordinary to you now, but after a time it will. It will become ordinary. And this is where this chapter ends, right? And again, ends in a fairly ominous way, and we're led next to the night section. We'll talk about these night sections again later in this process of memory that happens at night. You may have to remind me of all the things that I've just been talking about discussing later. Now, the other, of course, important way about that language comes into play here is in this act of storytelling. And she often refers to her narrative as a story, and one, and herself, if you'll remember, as something that she writes, something that she creates via writing, and the way her memory helps to construct a past and construct a self. And in the next audio lecture, I'm going to talk about that very thing. We're going to talk about memory and the idea of using the recollection of the past, the telling of her story, as a means of resistance. And that's where we're going to begin in the next lecture.